Public policy affects every aspect of your life, from the roads near your home and the lakes in your city, to education and health, to international trade and foreign policy. If you want to understand this interplay of politics, economics, polity and governance, Takshashila Institution's public policy courses are made just for you. The 12-week graduate certificate program gives you a window into the basics of public policy. You can choose to explore the areas of defense and foreign affairs, tech and policy, or advanced public policy. The course is completely online and is conducted on weekends, making it a perfect fit for working professionals. The applications for the May 2024 cohort are now open. Visit school.takshashila.org.in. For more information, visit www.school.takshashila.org.in or click the link in the show notes.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello and welcome to All Things Policy. I'm Manoj Kevalramani, and today I have with me a very special guest, author and journalist Amish Raj Malmi. His book, All Roads Lead North, Nepal's Turn to China, which was published in 2021, is probably one of the best reads on Nepal's foreign policy and the China-Nepal relationship. In today's conversation, I'll be asking Amish about the recent churn in Nepal's politics and its ties with China, particularly in the context of Foreign Minister Narayan Kaji Shrestha's recent visit to China. Amish, welcome to this conversation.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Manoj, and for the generous introduction as well.
No, I love the book. So, and I told you that when we met the last time. So I'm looking forward to this conversation. So since we have, you know, a fixed amount of time to go through this, let me just get into the first question directly that I had with you. There was a change in the government in Kathmandu recently. From what I understand, and this is complicated even for me, given that Indian politics can tend to be so complicated. But from what I understand is that the Prime Minister basically went back to his old ally, dumping his ally, the Nepali Congress, and went back to the Communist Party of Nepal, UML, and also inducted two other smaller parties to create a new coalition government. And then we had this new foreign minister whom we were talking about who traveled to China. So I want to first understand what prompted this change in alliance and if there are any implications of this from a foreign policy perspective.
I think that's a great question to begin with, Manoj, because, see, in my understanding, I think this change in government primarily came from coalition differences over domestic politics more than anything to do with like foreign policy. As I understand, the foundation of this, let's say, crisis came from the current prime minister wanting to go beyond his 2 years of prime ministership that he had agreed with the Nepali Congress. So the impact also, I think, is being felt more at the provincial level politics than on foreign policy right now. So I would say this change has been sort of prompted by domestic politics than external factors. But from a foreign policy perspective, it's an interesting change because China had long been encouraging these left parties to come together like they had done earlier. So the choice of ministers, this rapid engagement by China after this new government came into power suggests it is certainly more amenable to the new government. And one indicator that I'd like to give for this is that there was a recently held Lumbini International Peace Festival, which is supported by the Chinese embassy. This festival was announced as soon as the previous government fell and the provincial government of Lumbini, which had planned another peace summit in Lumbini, that was cancelled. And instead, in lieu of that, Chinese then organized this. So, and of course, like you said, the new foreign minister's recently concluded China visit also gives us an indicator. So the other thing is also that India's elections are coming, so perhaps we'll get a clearer sense of what Delhi and Kathmandu think after the elections. But one thing that is clear so far is that the government has not really signaled a change in terms of policies outlook. One measure that we usually use is that generally when a new government comes in, there are new deals, there are new projects being announced. None of that has happened so far. So we can say that, I mean, that's also happening over there right now. The other thing, like I said, domestic politics is taking over. So parliament has been continuously disrupted. The government has been busy, you know, firefighting, appointing ministers. So in a sense, the foreign policy direction of like this current government hasn't really changed much because the government hasn't really been able to function. So
fair enough. I think that makes a lot of sense, right? There hasn't been that much change. Although China was the choice for the foreign minister for his first visit, right? And we'll get into that a little bit more details into that visit. I want to now sort of go a little bit back into the past, right? I mean, initially when we were talking about this podcast, and I was throwing to you the question of talking about the change in China-Nepal relations under Xi Jinping, which is a long, long tenure.
Yeah.
And, you know, given the time constraints, I think we came to an agreement that let's look at 2019 and post-2019, because 2019 was Xi Jinping's first visit to Nepal and the first visit by a Chinese president in 2 decades, if I'm correct. Yeah. And there were some 20 big deals that were announced. There was a lot of investment that was talked about. So I wanted to get a sense from you as to what are the big changes in the relationship since 2019, you know, from multiple different perspectives, not just political engagement, but also economic engagement. I mean, I remember recently there was a comment by the Chinese about how they want to turn Nepal away from being landlocked to land linked and something to that effect. How has the relationship changed politically, but also from an economic point of view in terms of trade, investment, connectivity, and even debt?
I think that landlocked to land linked, I think Xi Jinping himself said that during his visit in Kathmandu. So I think it came from that. And that was also the time, around that time, when they announced this Trans-Himalayan Multidimensional Connectivity Network as part of BRI. But since 2019, particularly, I don't think a lot of the investment at least had materialized, but I'll come to that. But overall, if I sort of look at it from 2019, there's been ups and downs. China has made it clear that it prefers left parties in Nepal to be in power. The biggest sort of turnaround, or rather the biggest sort of factor in these years since 2019, has been COVID. So COVID dampened much of the enthusiasm after Xi's visit, especially due to delays in infrastructure that China was making in Nepal. The Chinese tourists, the numbers and the investment are yet to pick up to pre-COVID levels. But nonetheless, China has engaged widely with Nepal in other areas. The aid program has widened. There have been more people-to-people initiatives. China has, of course, been much more assertive as well during this period. It was commenting on Nepal's ties with the U.S. and in turn being accused of spreading disinformation inside the country by the U.S. when the MCC protests were happening. But I think the biggest setback, particularly for Nepal, has been 2020 Galwan and this rapid deterioration in India-China ties. So India has blocked market access to China-developed or China-funded infrastructure, airports, hydropower. So which means that Nepal has had to make tough choices while India has pressed home its economic leverage. So these sort of dynamics are slowly, let's say, taking shape. In terms of specific sectors, right? Trade, Nepal's exports to China have increased. Not by a lot, but they have certainly increased. Nonetheless, there is a massive deficit. I was just actually looking at some of the numbers, and the ratio is about 1:150 for like $1 export, $150 of import. So it's a very, very wide trade deficit that's still widening. A third land border point in Mustang recently opened up last October, but it will be a while because there is vast asymmetry in state capacity infrastructure. This during COVID, all the border points that are closed that hurt Nepali traders, but that's slowly easing out now. But the trade deficit, particularly what Nepal can export to China, I think that is a big question that Nepali policymakers are still trying to figure out. In terms of investment, India continues to have the highest FDI stock in the country. China has pledged in terms of, so there is a very interesting thing here. China has been saying that it's the highest FDI foreign investor in Nepal, but actually is the highest foreign investor in terms of pledges. So it has pledged more than $1 billion of investment in Nepal, but not a lot of it has materialized. A lot of the Chinese investment that we see right now are in the tourism sectors, in hotels, other services. Like I said, and hydropower, there was a lot of Chinese interest, but now that interest has been muted because of India's blockage of market access. China is still involved in a lot of infrastructure contracts and highways and hydropower and also irrigation networks inside Nepal. And as I told you earlier, that there is an investment summit that's happening in about 2 weeks' time. So we'll have to see how China then commits itself to Nepal in terms of investment after that. The other aspect of, like I said, the Trans-Himalayan Connectivity Network I mean, this railway feasibility survey happened. I believe it's still happening. There are a lot of the reports haven't been presented yet, but there is still some time to go before we agree on how do we fund this project. Because, of course, I mean, Nepal does not have the funds to do that. However, what's the one key development is that Nepal has recently exported to Japan via China. So that is a new positive that has come via the transit agreement. But again, I mean, China has been talking a lot about the new airports, but it has yet to commit any scheduled flights to Pokhara and Bhairava both. So that remains a speed breaker, I would say, in terms of connectivity between the two countries. That, I don't think there are any worries. I think it's also because Nepal owes more to multilateral institutions than bilateral. But also, I think the lessons from Sri Lanka and Pakistan have been very, very clear. And now, no Nepali policymaker has the appetite for expensive debt. Nepal has made this evidently clear to China. And I think this is also where Nepal has had several years of experience dealing with foreign institutions in terms of development finance. So I think that experience is helping it quite a bit, where it's clear that, okay, if you're getting debt for cheaper, if you're getting loans for cheaper from, let's say, the World Bank, from the ADB, it would like similar rates from China as well. So I think this, where we are right now, like I said earlier, since 2019, there have been a few ups. China has engaged widely. Chinese investments, you can see a few of them. You can see trade expanding, but it has really not gone the way China or Nepal both expected. I think, like I said, COVID was a big dampener. But beyond COVID as well, you know, let's say in terms of investments, in terms of the tourist numbers that is supposed to materialize, I don't think that has happened yet.
Yeah, I wanted to sort of pick on this idea of debt a little bit. Just as a quick follow-up is, there's been a lot of talk about the Pokhara Airport. And, you know, there has been some reportage that, you know, Nepal's preference is to convert it from a loan to a grant, at least a proportion of it, a significant proportion of it, so that it eases the debt burden in the future. I wanted to get two thoughts. Have you sort of heard anything about how the Chinese are responding to such suggestions? Also, what is the discourse in the media among the people around this idea? So whether the debt is real or not, there's a thing about public narrative, right? So what's the public narrative around debt and the airport?
I think I'll come to the second part first, right? Like, I think the debt, see, the discourse around the debt, it has some elements to it that there's been a lot of questioning around, all right, will this airport end up being another case of Hambantota? I don't think that the comparison is apt for several reasons. The first is that the loan is minuscule compared to, I wouldn't call it minuscule, sorry, that's the wrong word, but this loan is a much lower amount, a much lower sum than an Hambantota. So that's there. The second part is that in terms of the discourse, I think the worry here is more that the airport is non-functional rather than it being saddled with debt. And I think that comes from the idea that once the airport functions to its fullest, the revenues will automatically start pouring in, right? And this is where the discourse around the airport is basically, the media discourse, where it centers is, there are two parts to this. One part is that India is obviously not very pleased with the airport being declared a BRI project, with the airport being developed by Chinese developers. So that hesitation, that sort of like, that's a displeasure, is quite evident. You can see that you have, like, I mean, there are whispers of that all across. So that is quite evident. The second part of it, which is that why has China not then scheduled flights to it? Or why have other, let's say, countries not been able to schedule flights to it? I think that is a question that Nepali policymakers have not been able to answer. I don't think the Nepali media has also discussed enough of this, but this is a question that remains pretty, let's say, prominent, that if, okay, India may have a problem, but what are the reasons that other countries are not flying to this airport? And I think that is where the discourse will lead to in the days to come, the more the airport remains non-functional. It is, so for instance, China has continued to defend the airport by saying, the Chinese ambassador recently said on Twitter that passenger traffic has doubled since the opening of the new airport. But that is also because it functions as a domestic airport, and because of the new technology that has been used in the airport, flights, there are now night flights to Pokhara. So obviously passenger traffic will increase. But for now, it remains a domestic airport, and that is how it is, right? In terms of the converting of the loan to grant, now there are two components to the loan. the first part, the 25% of the loan is actually interest-free. And a lot of the individuals that I've spoken to who from Pokhara, not from Pokhara, who have been involved, who pushed, who sort of lobbied for the airport, who knew, and the know-how of the what happened during construction, tell me that the Chinese had said it is possible that this 25% interest-free would be converted into a grant. That has also not happened. Whether the foreign minister picked it up during his visit, whether this issue, this idea that, all right, can this be converted into a grant, I am not sure. But the commentary that I see on, let's say, Chinese media, there was a recent piece, I think it was Global Times, I could be wrong, but there was a commentary that I read where it said that it should, by converting this loan, even the interest-free loan, into a grant, China will send out a wrong message to other countries. And perhaps that is one reason why that discussion is also not going ahead. So it's in a curious place right now. Very interesting, right? Like, now, so I'm from Pokhara. And in Pokhara, I don't think anyone doubts the airport existence, right? They believe that there is, from the government to locals, I think there is unanimous agreement that the airport should have been made, right? Yeah. The question is, how do we get this to function? And that is where I think a lot of blame now is not on the Chinese as much as it's on the Nepali policymakers, the Nepali Civil Aviation Authority, that has not been able to do the homework to get this airport to operate. And it's not just Pokhara, right? It's Bhairava as well. And Bhairava, there are serious Indian concerns because of, ILS, because of border sharing airspace, all of that. But again, in Bhairava's case, why haven't Chinese airlines operated flights, scheduled flights to Bhairava? They are organizing Lumbini festivals. They're interested in Lumbini. They see a greater cultural engagement happening there. But that is one part that should have happened by now. Yeah. Because it hasn't happened, I would term it a failure on our part, on Nepal's authorities' parts, to fail to negotiate with Chinese or, let's say, even Southeast Asian countries to fly into these airports.
Yeah. No, fascinating. You talked about whether the foreign minister, when he visited China, did he raise this issue of loans and grants? And it's interesting to see that a lot of the commentary in Nepal seems to be focused more on the domestic policymakers rather than externalizing the problem, which is a good sign, which is always a sign of the press being more free, when you can actually pick on your leaders rather than create foreign bogeys. I wanted to come to the visit of the foreign minister. So it was a long visit. It was 9 days. And he had substantive meetings with a bunch of people across the Chinese ecosystem. What were the objectives of this visit? Because, like we were talking before the recording, nothing specific seems to have been announced as an outcome of this visit. So what were the objectives of this visit, and what according to you has been achieved?
So this is an entirely subjective view. So please don't read this as anything else. I think in my view, right, like the foreign minister, the current foreign minister, he has shown to be closer to, to prefer China more than India, because you can see that in his policy preferences, in his articulation over time. And we can also see the attention, like you said, China gave him a lot of attention, 9-day long visit, including he visited Chongqing, Sichuan and Tibet, or rather Tar, as they call it. All these three units or provinces or cities, however you want to term it, they are the ones who are responsible, let's say, for dealing with Nepal from the Chinese side. So my sense is that we have to read this visit as much from a political perspective as from a G2G. So politically, China has signaled that it's always more open to working with left governments in Nepal than with a coalition where the Nepali Congress was a major partner. So I think this visit also suggests that China is much more amenable to this government. Like I said earlier, government or state to state wise, there isn't anything that is really new that came out, except I would say that the idea of a foreign ministerial level dialogue mechanism that was being proposed, I think that will achieve some sort of equanimity between, let's say, Nepal's two neighbors. But the foreign minister has been saying that China has been willing to open all 14 border points, but that is also nothing new, because the onus right now is on Nepal. And whether it has the state capacity right now to be ready to open these border points to begin with, right? That China has the state capacity. And I was recently in Mustang. You can see that. Nepal, there is vast asymmetry. I don't think even Mustang, which Nepal-China announced in October 2023, I don't think it will be ready to freight traffic for at least another 5 to 10 years. So you can see the asymmetry over there. So I don't think there's anything new. So the main thing, I think the visit centered around this BRA implementation agreement, which was not signed, but there were discussions around that. There are some suggestions that it may be signed in very soon. But the key question obviously remains that Nepal earlier had issues with a few security cooperation clauses inside the BRA implementation agreement. Whether those clauses have been removed, whether those clauses have been modified, that remains to be seen. So because the new updated agreement has not been released to the public yet. So.
Okay, so that was going to be my next question, which is about that BRI implementation plan. Because, again, it seems to... There was some anticipation, I remember reading in the press, that they could be discussing that and you could see some sort of an outcome on that. But it's obviously not happened. Along with BRI, of course, there are these different initiatives that Xi Jinping has launched, which is the Global Development and Global Security and Global Civilization Initiative. I want to get your sense on what's the discussion, if at all any, in Nepal around these three initiatives. What do they mean for Nepal? Because if I'm correct, there are GDI projects in Nepal. In the list of the first 50 there were, and I think even in the next, the overall 200 projects from what I recall last that they had, there are projects in Nepal. So what is the read in Nepal around these three initiatives? What does China want to achieve with this, and how does Nepal think about these?
I'll start with this BRI thing, right? Like, I mean, this BRI implementation plan, I think it's very curious because no other BRI country has signed one, if I remember correctly. I don't think any other country has had a BRI implementation agreement. And I think why Nepal wants one is because there is a mismatch between how Nepal looks at BRI and how China has been looking at BRI. I think Nepal has been assuming the BRI to be project-led, and there are specific projects that are listed in the BRI, and those are the only ones. Whereas China has been pushing it more as a policy initiative under five umbrellas, let's say financial connectivity, you know, like various digital connectivity issues like that, right? Policy harmonization, things like that. So I think there is this mismatch. And we can see Nepal's pushback when China unilaterally declared this Pokhara airport to be a BRI. So I think that's the first part of this implementation agreement that's supposed to smoothen out. The second part that's supposed to, this agreement is supposed to address is the funding modalities, the financing modalities. Like I said, I mean, I don't think Nepal has the capacity to take on any more loans at the moment, at least the rates that China was giving earlier. So the key question is basically that how, let's say, if the implementation agreement will address this and how it will address that. Like, right? And no, as for GDI, GSI, GCI, all these acronyms, and you've also pointed this out elsewhere, the sense is obviously in Nepal that China is pushing these ideas as messaging, you know, of its own view of the world, its conceptualization of various, you know, diplomacy efforts. And with GSI, I mean, Nepal's hesitation is obvious. It's linked to its anxieties about not being dragged into any security alliances. The GDI, like you said, like, I mean, Nepal is already a part of it. In fact, there are some projects that are happening. But very curiously, when the 10-year BRI white paper was launched, when it was published, there were two projects that came that were identified as BRI projects in Nepal in that white paper, which is that it's a Panda Pack project and the Amity Drinking Water Project. Now, both of these, now the Panda Pack deals with education. The Amity Drinking Water Project deals with, like, drinking water, right? So it seems that there is a sort of blurring between GDI and BRI, where, let's say, BRI has... What makes GDI sort of distinct from BRI is not fully clear. At least to me, it's not clear, right? But it's obviously evident that BRI, at least in Nepal, has undergone a tremendous shift from its, let's say, from 2019 itself, from being conceptualized as hard infra, such as the train from Tibet, to incorporating this purely developmental assistance that other countries, other NGOs have long been doing in Nepal, and China itself has long been doing in Nepal as well. So this distinction between GDI and BRI's softer side, that's not really clear to me right now. And GCI, again, I mean, Nepal has not signed up to it, but the Chinese ambassador last June, if I remember correctly, there was a sort of a dragon boat race in Pokhara. And boat racers from Sichuan, from China, had been brought down to race with Nepali boat racers. And the ambassador identified that as a GCI project. So these definitions, I think I'll defer to you on this idea of what exactly makes GDI, GCI, and the BRI different from each other. Now, the other curious part is also in Nepal, China has launched something called the Silk Roadster Project. Now, it comes under BRI, it comes under GDI. That's again not clear. But Silk Roadster is very interesting in that the outline document says that it will be used for training political personnel at the local level and local authorities, and they will be trained in China. There will be, it's essentially political influence building, right? Inclusion of that under these ideas again raises the question of how is, let's say, China's larger diplomacy, is it all coming together? Are these all distinct strands? I really can't say for now.
That's fascinating, right? Just as a follow-up again, this, when you see China doing these things, which is about training local officials or sharing governance experiences, people can't see it, but I was doing air quotes. So the idea of sharing governance experiences, do you see that as China cultivating political capital in the country because it sees, it sees that it needs to cultivate that political capital because of its interests? Or do you see this as an export of values, ideology? Or is this divide also meaningless because they intersect from a Chinese point of view?
I would say the third. I mean, from Nepal's perspective, I think it's the latter. It's the export of values. But from China's perspective, at least the sense I get that it's both influence building as well as export of values. China, when the Nepali Communist Party came together, when the Maoists and the UML came together to formally become the NCP, I mean, they signed an official agreement with the CCP and imported Xi Jinping thought, like officially Xi Jinping thought. And they were training their cadre in that. Whether such training is still happening, I'm not sure, because the NCP no longer stands. But it's quite clear that, I mean, you can see the ILD taking a great interest. You can see, political parties, political leaders here meeting ILD personnel. I mean, just recently, the vice chair of the ILD was in Kathmandu as well. Last year, the chair of the ILD was here as well. So there's a lot of interaction at the political level, And to me, it seems like it's both, right? Like, I mean, it's both you're exporting values, but you at the same time, this export of values counts as political influence building. So,
yeah. No, that makes sense. That makes a lot of sense. All right. So connected to that is what my final question was, and I thought we could get to this, is that how does, in general, the political class, I mean, is there cross-party agreement in terms of how Nepal should be dealing with the competition between China and the United States and India? Because India is obviously a big player in Nepal in domestic politics, like we've talked about, and its worldview given geography in itself and history. I mean, across the political class, what's the view on dealing with this increasing sort of sense of bipolarity, although not bipolarity, and India's role in all of this, right? What's the sense of that?
Well, I think, Nepal's leaders, Nepal's officials, government secretaries, they make it clear that non-alignment remains the foundation, right? Nepal will not align itself with any country in terms of any military or security alliance. So it's been very, very clear to, sort of steer clear of, let's say, the Indo-Pacific, even though the Indo-Pacific is a wider ambit, but because of the American connotation with military, as a military alliance, the Indo-Pacific in Nepal wants to stay clear of it. Similarly, the same logic goes for something like the GSI. So I think there is a sort of clear understanding that there is great power competition happening. There is India-China competition happening. We need to stay out of it. How we do that is by rejecting the military alliance while accepting, let's say, engagements on other fronts. So be it, let's say, development finance, be it investments, be it, let's say, people-to-people connectivity. I think on those terms, on those ideas, Nepal is willing to expand, engage with all powers, including, let's say, India, China, US, it's been, I don't think there's been any preference as such. But when it comes to security or, let's say, military-wise, Nepal does not want to make a choice over there. So that is quite, quite evident. The other part of this is, I think, this larger, more than the Sino-US competition, I think the India-China competition is leaving more of a, let's say, very little wriggling room for Nepali policymakers. India has been leveraging its economic potential, its economic its markets for hydropower, its markets for others and sort of goods. India has been leveraging that. And Nepal understands that very, very clearly. There was a hydropower project called Upper Tamakoshi, which is about 400 megawatts. And India has absolutely refused to buy power from it. Why? Because a Chinese contractor was involved in it. But an Indian contractor was also involved in it. That doesn't matter to India. Delhi has simply said no. And no means no, right? So I think that India's clear-cut message has been made very, very clear to Nepal. And now Nepal has to negotiate its way around this, let's say, conundrum. So yes. one way out that it's looking at, and something that the Prime Minister also said a couple of months ago, was that if the Chinese would like to develop hydropower projects in Nepal for export, we can export the power to China.
Yeah.
You know? And I think there are discussions happening over power trade with China, especially in the lean months for the TAR region. But I don't know how far that will go ahead. So.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really difficult. At a certain level, it's useful to have this tool which says that, okay, I'm defining security as hard security and I'm going to stay away from that, but economics I'm going to deal with, and that's fine because, of course, I need to, right? I've got economic needs. But the challenge is, of course, that economics today is also security. And increasingly, it becomes really difficult to draw that bifurcation. My final question to you, and since you're here, I'm going to take advantage of that, is that, we have elections coming in India, in very, very soon now. What's the reading in Nepal around the elections? What's the anticipation? Is there a sense? I mean, firstly, I'm sure there's people closely following it. Yeah. Is there any expectation of, policy shifts in India, with Nepal after the election? Or is the anticipation that you're likely to, whoever is in power in India, you're likely to see more of the same?
I think, the hardening of India-China ties, how India is looking at China, I don't think that's going to stop. Right. And now this is more of a, let's say, personal observation than, let's say, a larger, let's say, discourse of what's happening over here. So the India-China contest is going to harden. How India is going to look at China is going to harden. So in terms of policy continuity, that is expected, right? It doesn't matter who will come into power in India. By all readings, it seems the current party will continue into power. But so you can see in terms of policy continuity that happens, right? Where I think the challenge for Nepal will lie is if India decides to up the ante vis-a-vis China. Let's say, for instance, right now, like you said, there's election season happening. Despite that, you can see the defense minister going to Arunachal. You can see, there's a lot of pushback against these sort of Chinese narratives over, disputed areas. And I think it will, toughen, the position will toughen after the elections. For Nepal, the challenge then will be, how do you engage with this tougher, tougher posturing India vis-a-vis China, which also keeps in, mind Nepali interests. For instance, there is a simple fact that I think Indians also understand, and I think Nepalis are very clear on that, is that Chinese are some of the cheapest contractors available, in terms of infrastructure, in terms of hydro, anything, right? But how do you deal with that? Unless there is an alternative. Unless, for instance, in the recent, the MCC, which is the US-led grant program to build transmission lines for power export to India, Indian companies, three or four Indian companies bid for the transmission line contract. All of them overbid the contract. So the contracts haven't been handed out. So in that scenario, where the financing of, projects, the financing of infrastructure, which is obviously Nepal's great aspiration, right? Unless that can be sorted out, how does India assume that Nepal will have to deal with these, Chinese contractors in the years to come? How does India assume that is going to happen? Similarly, Kathmandu will have to find that way out, Kathmandu will have to find a way out. And this is where something that I have noted elsewhere is that there is a convergence, as in the elsewhere, right, where the US and India are coming together on China.
Yeah.
And that convergence may be useful, may be helpful for Nepal, but then Nepal has to, use it to its advantage. Like you said, economics is so closely tied into geosecurity, geopolitics right now. The idea of, the Indian foreign minister has made it clear that technology is pretty much national security, right? So with all these things coming in, Nepal's biggest challenge will be finding that negotiating or sort of like, you know, that route that makes choices available to it while keeping track of its own interests. And that is really a tough ask. So I don't envy Nepali policymakers for sure. So
I hear you. Amish, thank you so much for that really in-depth look at things within about 35 minutes to provide such nuanced and detailed take into how Nepal approaches China, but also India and the region, and along with, of course, the domestic discourse within the country around its geopolitics. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you so much, Manoj.
If you liked our show, dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs. Check us out at our Twitter handle at takshashilainst or our website takshashila.org.in.